taking the members into the Nugent report for purposes of placing it into context, but I want to go back to where I was in the affidavit of Mr. Pillay in response to the subpoena. And we had read the excerpt, the one paragraph from the in paragraph 31.7.9, you put it on the screen, of the Nugent Commission report, and I go to 31.7.10, right? So we've contextualized the Nugent Commission report in the context of the subject matter of the Public Protector's report, and Mr. Pillay's affidavit in response to a subpoena to him had only encapsulated the one paragraph in that affidavit. He then, in paragraph 31.7.10, says to the Public Protector, a subsequent admission by retired Judge Gruen under oath in March 2019 that all the members of the so-called Gruen Advisory Board had deliberated the statement between May to June 2015 that the unit was unlawfully established, as put forth by the so-called Sikakani panel. The Gruen Advisory Board then concluded that it was indeed wrong to have concluded this. So what is recorded by Mr. Pillay under oath to the Public Protector is not simply the apology, but it went further than that. It then said, these facts can be determined from retired Judge Gruen and the members of that board directly. And at 31.9, it says, however, public records exist that set out in detail the legality of the unit, its establishment, mandate, and its existence had been public knowledge for years and explained in detail. And then he sets out Annexure D, and in particular, paragraph 5.21 thereof, in this regard, I personally participated in briefing members of Parliament, the Presidency, the State Security Agency, and parliamentary committees on these matters since 2010. Two, my submissions to the Sikakani panel. My submissions to the Sikakani report addressed to Mr. Muyani. The so-called snowman broken arrow bundle, which I attach marked F. Various letters and minutes of meetings and documents provided to the Presidency, South African Police Service, State Security Agency, various members of Parliament, Ministry of Finance, and parliamentary committees between February 2010 to 2014. A best-selling book entitled Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade in the chapter Juju and the Poacher, published in 2012, names the unit openly associated with SARS and explains its mandate. The book has, to my knowledge, been republished 6 times since then. Then he also provides a charge sheet in which he has been criminally charged, and that is to be found at PDF 427. Actually, don't go down. I just want to show that it's the next. The reason why we're not going down, it's because the address of those who are charged, which include Mr. Pillay, Mr. Van Lochenberg at that time, is provided. And this submission was made to the Public Protector in April 2019. So by that stage, no, I don't want to, the addresses are not blanked out to do that. So if we go to page 445, um, Mr. Pillay is then served with a Section 7(i) notice, and this is the affidavit which he then provides the public protector in response to the Section 7(i) notice. This is also annexed to his founding, to his papers before, to the affidavit of Mr. Goodan, the founding papers before the High Court. And I want to draw your attention to a few of those paragraphs. Let's go to paragraph 9. Where he draws particular attention that to the fact that in paragraph 14.4.33 of the notice, the public protector concludes on the strength of the evidence before her that Mr. Andries Jansen van Rensburg and Mr. Pillay are guilty of the very charge, let's read it in the first person, that we have been indicted for, the trial of which is presently pending in the High Court Gauteng Division. The public protector impermissibly seeks to preempt the outcome of the trial. In doing so, she tramples on my constitutional guaranteed rights to a fair trial. I wish to point out that the National Director of Public Prosecutions has embarked upon the process set out in Section 179(5) of the Constitution to review the decision to prosecute. It appears that the public protector seeks to influence that process to my detriment and to the detriment of Mr. Jansen van Rensburg by predetermining and proclaiming our supposed guilt in our intended report. Mr. Pillay then makes certain in general comments, which he starts at paragraph 15. Some of the other paragraphs are background or have appeared in the affidavit that I previously brought to the committee's attention. And he says, I place on the record that I do not agree with what the public protector describes in the notice as a intended, likely, provisional or preliminary findings, which terms are used interchangeably in the notice in their totality. I shall simply refer to them in this affidavit as findings. In my view, the findings amount to misrepresentations and distortions of the truth to the actual and potential prejudice and detriment of me and others, SARS and the country as a whole. The notice is replete with loosely used terms, specifically the term COVID and intelligence, that are not defined in law and are also not defined or explained in the notice. In this regard, I record that neither COVID and discrete investigations, nor the practice of collecting intelligence, nor the practices of collecting actual or potential evidence, finding information that would guide investigations, investigating, identifying witnesses and whistleblowers, and determining the location of actual or potential evidence discreetly, covertly, or under protection of SARS confidentiality legislation directly related to serious offenses against SARS, inter alia, tax evasion, customs invasion, excise invasion, fraud, smuggling, racketeering, money laundering, and corruption can remotely be considered as improper, unlawful, illegal, or questionable in any manner or form. The only limitation in law in this regards relates specifically to conducting covert intelligence, specifically in relation to national security matters, which are both terms defined in law. The public protector, in determining what she repeatedly refers to as the rogue SIC unit as being unlawful, has effectively neutered the entire enforcement capability of SARS, the result of which is clearly legally untenable and patently irrational. I further place on record that what the public protector has set out in the notice as constituting the reason and basis for findings demonstrate that the findings are neither rational nor reasonable. The findings are as a result from errors of fact and law. The public protector has failed in the investigation to be proactive, impartial, and determined in the investigation and to retain an open and inquiring mind in the course thereof. The public protector has approached the investigation in a biased manner. Public protector relies on false representations made by various parties and accepts and presents these as effect. Several statements contained in the notice of the public protector are patently false and defamatory. And the public protector omits material facts and evidence at her disposal were accessible to her or available in the public domain, a proper consideration of which would have resulted in her findings being completely different. Furthermore, the public protector has deliberately omitted to reflect, detail, and consider materially relevant factual evidence and facts which demonstrate organized and coordinated efforts by various parties and groups, one, to disrupt and cause chaos at SARS, hound people out of SARS and humiliate them that they can never find work again, unlawfully and illegally spy on, attack, and discredit SARS and its officials, and audits and investigations, including the finance minister, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, Mr. Johan van Lochenburg, and others at SARS, including me, replace the leadership of SARS and remove the Minister of Finance, facilitate the ultimate state capture of SARS as institution, and six, commit serious offences against SARS, inter alia tax evasion, customs evasion, excise evasion, fraud, smuggling, racketeering, money laundering, and corruption. These omissions by the public protector pertain in the main to a deliberate and false propaganda campaign in relation to what has notoriously been referred to as the SARS rogue unit. This campaign of disinformation commenced in earnest in the popular media on 12 October 2014 and has continued ever since with the assistance of inter alia, current and former SARS officials, state intelligence operatives, and law enforcement officials, taxpayers in dispute with SARS, and politically connected individuals and select persons in the media. The public protector has failed to properly investigate the matters in their totality. The notice contains intentional, unlawful misrepresentations to my actual and potential prejudice. The findings, as well as a public statement by way of video distributed on social media, issued by the public protector on 3 June 2019, when she revealed that she was serving a Section 7(i) notice on Minister Gordhan, and the public protector's further utterances at public speaking venues in her official capacity served to advance the rogue unit propaganda campaign. In the 3 June 2019 communication, the public protector had already announced to the public her findings by referring to the existence of a rogue unit. In that statement, the public protector, amongst numerous other false and defamatory utterances, falsely and in a defamatory manner, cast me and others involved in the same light as murderers. In this regard, my attorneys addressed a letter on 14 June 2019 to the public protector on my behalf, copy of which is annexed. On 17 June 2019, the public protector's attorney sent a dismissive, emotional, and threatening response. Next, the public protector appears to have adopted a position that will brook no disagreement with her, which assumes that any challenge to her utterances, whether on social media, in public address, or in her reports, amounts to interference with her work. There was no rogue unit. The public protector, as evidenced by the content of the letter of her attorneys, dated 17 June 2019, appears to believe that this loaded appellation is perfectly proper because it is commonly coined and publicly known. And in the absence of a court order prohibiting its use, the appellation remains usable by all South Africans, including the public protector. I submit that, contrary to that belief, stubborn and deliberate use of the term rogue unit by the public protector in circumstances where the very issue that she is investigating is whether or not the unit was lawful, demonstrates her bias and closure of her mind to any outcome to her investigation other than one which upholds and confirms the rogue unit narrative. The notice issued by the public protector indicates that her findings are dealt with in a first part, which will be followed by a second volume. The notice then relates to the first part as set out in paragraphs 8.1 to 8.6. I do not intend to refer to any of the matters that the public protector has decided to defer to her intended second volume. I merely remark that this is a strange way of conducting an investigation and appears aimed at involving those likely to be implicated in the second volume in additional cost and effort. It seems clear, however, that the public protector wishes to expedite the publication of her contribution to the rogue unit narrative. At paragraph 28, he then starts dealing with evidence. The notice uses the term evidence loosely throughout the content. In this regard, I've been advised that evidence is not simply allegation, but factual material which might prove or disprove the allegation in question. The notice is replete with conjecture and speculation described as evidence and apparently relied on by the public protector as if it was actual evidence. Evidence not given under oath generally carries little weight. It is also well established that the existence of a document or recording does not constitute proof of the correctness of the content of the document or recording. Courts of law and tribunals such as the public protector, which investigate and report on allegations, make findings of fact based on evidence and draw conclusions based on those factual findings and the law. A statement or allegation made by someone that certain evidence exists or that certain events occurred is neither a finding of fact nor a final conclusion. Prima facie evidence is generally accepted by courts and fact-finding tribunals to mean evidence which, in the absence of rebutting or contrary evidence, furthermore, and then he refers to the oft-quoted case of Sample, and the citation is there where the SCA had stated that primary facts are facts which are directly established by evidence. It is secondary facts are facts which are established by inferences, by inference from the primary facts, and that the drawing of an inference for the purposes of establishing a secondary fact is also a finding of fact. With regard to the drawing of inferences, our courts have repeatedly quoted with approval the following statement. Inference must be carefully distinguished from conjecture or speculation. There can be no inference unless there are objective facts from which to infer the other facts which it is sought to establish. But if there are no positive proved facts from which the inference can be made, the method of inference fails, and what is left is mere speculation or conjecture. South African courts have also consistently affirmed that in considering reports by the public protector, the court will interfere with and overturn a finding and recommended remedial action if there is not a rational objective basis which justifies them. The notice is replete with speculation and conjecture. It is extremely difficult to follow and make sense of it because it is clearly rushed to completion, exhibiting scant, if any, regard for facts and evidence relevant to the complaints. And then he says he's going to set out issues that he deals with. Facts, references, evidence, the location of such evidence and witnesses and records, many drawn from the public domain and all of which are material to the matters raised in the notice. Without exception, they have all clearly been ignored by the public protector during her investigation. If you go to paragraph 32 and following, he deals with the establishment of the unit as explained. And he says, I wish to recall that the notice demonstrates a complete lack of understanding or even an attempt of understanding SARS as an institution, its various enforcement and investigative units over the years, 1998 to 2014, the legal and policy framework with which these units operated, their mandates and how they functioned, as set out in my submission. In the result, the notice reflects cardinal factual errors and untruths, which I deal with specifically later in this affidavit. For instance, the notice confuses separate SARS business units that reported to completely different divisions and subdivisions under completely different management structures with completely different budgets, oversight controls, organizational attributes, functions, and purposes. And it gives one example as an elementary example. The notice confuses the CBCU, which resorted under customs operations, with the National Research Group, which reported to the subdivision, which in turn resorted under Enforcement and Risk Division. In turn, a further confusion is added by confusing the AKAS, which was a standalone division, and the AKAS dealt with corruption, reporting to the General Manager of Risk and Enforcement and later to the SARS Commission. Similarly, at inception, the Special Project Unit was a small subunit under the CBCU division and shortly after transferred to an entirely different division named Enforcement and Risk. And so he goes on and he explains a legal opinion, some of which we have already read to you. And I want to take you specifically to paragraph 82. It has been stated on record, wrongly so, by SARS spokesperson, in particular Mr. Luther Lebello, at various times that I, as acting SARS commissioner, had initiated investigations into allegations of a rogue unit at SARS. This is false. I wish to record certain key aspects regarding these processes. And then he says, former SARS Commissioner Tom Uyane started at SARS on 1 October 2014 after his appointment was announced. The Sekakane panel concluded its report on 5 November. The notion of a rogue unit in the scope of the panel's report was introduced by the panel itself sometime later in October 2014. The Sekakane panel stated this in the report. Paragraph 757 says, it must be stated that the existence of such a unit in any form was not specifically part of the terms of reference. However, the terms of reference existed in our view to the consideration of the existence and operation of a COVID unit to the extent that we had not considered such issues. Once they became apparent, we would have failed in our obligation to fully respond to our mandate. If you then go to paragraph 83.6. The Sekakane panel's paragraph also admits by that time the panel had decided to extend its mandate to include allegations of the unit, they had already interviewed SARS officials and therefore did not hear them on any of these allegations. The report states that by this time we had already interviewed some SARS officials, including Mr. Van Lochtenberg. Therefore, contrary to what some would want the public to believe, the Sekakane panel was not instituted by me to investigate allegations of a rogue unit or any SARS unit, and clearly by their own account, the members of the panel took this upon themselves on a date around 12 October 2014 after hearing multiple without hearing multiple persons on these allegations, without informing me, and in particular not hearing Messrs. Johan van Lochtenberg, Andries Jansen van Redburg, or Pickle, Peter Richer. Not only do I take issue with the factual flawed and contradictory nature of the content of the Sekakane panel report, as set out in my critique, but also with what the report ignores and omits. In this regard, here I am specifically referring to serious criminality and the motives of those behind the allegations against SARS and its officials. I also specifically refer to the obligation which rested on the panel to report evidence placed before it in terms of Section 34 of PRECA as amended and the failure to do so being a criminal offence. In addition, despite what some would want the public to believe, the Sekakane panel made no adverse findings against me or Mr. Richard. This was confirmed publicly by the instructing attorney of the panel, Mr. Imran Mohammed, who stated that the panel had made no findings against Polo Richer. He stated that no such findings were made against any third party. So no finding was made against the Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Ivan Pele, or Mr. Richer. The Sekakane panel is profoundly flawed in fact and law. I've already provided the public protector with my critique, but this had not been reflected on in the notice. I wish to quote two paragraphs from my critique based on the procedural and substantive and general deficiencies in the report as detailed above. I'm of the view that the report poses a significant and unwarranted risk for SARS if the report were to be published in its present form. The report also has the potential to tarnish not only the reputation of SARS, but also the reputation of those who are implicated by the unfounded opinions and the recommendations of the report. In light of the above, I recommend that the report, together with its response and all other relevant material, be referred to a retired judge from the Supreme Court of Appeal. Every party that is affected by the issues in the report should be allowed to make representations to the judge. The judge would then make factual findings available to the commissioner so that he can decide on the best course forward. Got that? I'm aware that the Sekakaini panel report was challenged by Mr. van Lochenburg, both the SARS and the so-called Kruin Advisory Board. Parts of such have been published in the public domain and which the public protector has had no regard to in the notice. Having regard to what is stated in support of its findings and recommendations, it is clear that the report is materially flawed in fact and law. Any reliance by the public protector for any purpose on the Sekakaini panel report is irrational in place. This is especially so in circumstances which have been challenged and rebutted formally by several people, including me, and in as much as these challenges have not been considered and reflected in the notice. This is further compounded by the fact that the very complainant who led the original allegations that caused the institution of the Sekakaini panel, Ms. Holters, has pointed out significant and fatal flaws in the Sekakaini panel report under oath before the High Court, as pointed out by Mr. van Lochenburg. And then it goes to the KPMG report that I'm coming back to. Go to paragraph 97.4. Go up just to 97 so we can get the file. Then what is contained in the notice is once again a manifestation of ever-changing allegations by way of example. And then you go to 97.4. The allegation again changed with the introduction of the vague and unexplained finding by the Sekakaini panel that the unit was unlawfully established. Sekakaini panel paid scant regard to the unit's activities over the 7 years of its existence to inform this view. To the limited extent that the Sekakaini panel did reflect on the work of the unit, it said the following. Negotiations were commenced between SARS and NIA, but did not progress to a point where the plan became a reality. As fate would have it, when the negotiations failed, SARS had already started gathering the required personnel experience in intelligence work and already started conducting limited intelligence work against organized crime. It is generally accepted that the unit never progressed to conduct anything more than the limited intelligence it did when it started. This limited intelligence work entailed desktop research and physical surveillance tracking with the use of borrowed vehicle tracking devices, two or three cases in its entire lifespan. It is also generally accepted that the efforts of this intelligent team had impressive returns against organized crime throughout most of its existence. Through its work, the unit has been able to contribute immensely to the creation of the best revenue service in the continent and one of the best in the world. Further, notably, all of those we interviewed who knew about the NRG/HRIU and or were part of it remained adamant that the unit did not have the capacity to intercept communication. In fact, all the unit's operatives, both in respect of the old NRG and the new HRIU, either asserted that the unit did not have equipment to carry out electronic surveillance and or interception of communication, or were uncertain about whether such surveillance and or interception of communication had occurred or not. However, as a general rule, it was accepted that the unit did not have the required equipment to carry out such electronic surveillance or interception. Ms. Walters makes various allegations of other confidential taxpayer information having been disclosed to her by Mr. van Lochenburg, which is expressly disputed by Mr. van Lochenburg. The same applies in relation to alleged interceptions made by SARS. Are we at one? Just go back up. Although he was indeed intimately involved in the functioning and later management of the NRG, there's no direct evidence linking him to any illegal interception of conversation of Mr. Ms. Walters or any other taxpayer. And then go to paragraph 141. He says, the allegations contained in the Sikakani panel report as quoted are emphatically denied. The Sikakani panel proffered no substantiation, rational, or evidence whatsoever in support of these allegations. To the contrary, where evidence was provided to the Sikakani panel of serious efforts by members of other government agencies, including those tasked with investigating organized crime and collections of intelligence to undermine SARS, its work, and its officials, this was ignored and not reflected in the report. Paragraph 142, he says, it is noted that the Sikakani panel report made a recommendation, and this was without having to put the, and this was for a further investigation to be conducted. Mr. Pele says it is denied ever that this recommendation was ever seen through. In fact, the Inspector General of Intelligence has no jurisdiction over SARS in law. I have dealt with the purported report of the Inspector General of Intelligence and SARS-related responses here too. I have already dealt with the fact that the SARS unit's existence has never been denied by SARS. The facts of the matter are simply enough in public knowledge. Right? And then, so he's put in an extensive submission in respect to the Section 7I notice. The report then comes out and the committee's familiar with parts of the report. I want to now go to the affidavits that has been filed in the litigation. Shepo, if you can go back to the note, evidence from the different reports. And what we've done is similar to what I did last week, is a table reflecting the allegations, go down to further down. We've basically covered all of us, come to the heading that says litigation, case 8-4, and go down. Next page, there we go. Go up, yeah. Further up, top of that page, I think. No, go further. Yep, right. So what we have as a start is Minister Gordhan brings an application, which he does in part A and part B. Part A being to interdict the report, and part B to have it reviewed and set aside, and he files a founding affidavit. The public protector then files an answer, and Minister Gordhan files a reply. Mr. Pele comes in as an intervening party, and he files an affidavit to support effectively the relief sought by Minister Gordhan. And the public protector then files an answer to Mr. Pele. And so in the first part, this only deals with the issues relating to the Sikakani report and the vermins in contrast, very similar to what we did last week, where I took out the allegations relating to the IGI report so one could see what was before the court and what had been alleged. And so Minister Gordhan states that the public protector relies heavily on the discredited report by the Sikakani panel in reaching erroneous findings. The public protector merely lists this issue as one of the allegations made by the applicant. No response to the relevant paragraphs of the founding affidavit, and she states that she will, for purposes of the interdict, confine her response to the allegations appearing from paragraph 158 of the applicant's founding affidavit. Right? And in the replying affidavit, the minister says, in addition, the main source relied on by the public protector's finding and the EFF's case is now hopelessly and irredeemably tainted and can only be rejected because the discredited Sikakani panel reached an incorrect legal conclusion when it found the establishment of the SARS investigative unit contravened Section 3 of the National Strategic Intelligence Act 39 of 1994. Minister Gordhan's affidavit, which comes later, says, I wish to make it clear at the outset that I don't oppose the relief sought by Minister Gordhan in either part A or B and fully supports the relief sought. The public protector says, I have addressed allegations made in the applicant's affidavit, which are largely repeated by Mr. Pillay. And when I deal with part B of the application, which relates to the press for the review and setting aside, she would deal with the allegations of Mr. Pillay's affidavit that relates to the review application. And she's only going to deal with part A. So that's the landscape against which the public protector's initial answering affidavit must be considered. It's only dealing with the interim interdict. So I preface that because whilst there are certain allegations which are not answered for part A, the public protector makes it very clear that she's going to deal with it in part B. So one cannot take the view that the allegation is made undisputed. I'll go down. Right. The minister says the Sekakani panel rendered a report to Mr. Muyani that misapplied the law, erroneously concluded that the SARS investigative unit was unlawfully established. Right. And again, Mr. Pillay associates himself with the relief. Mr. Muyani used the Sekakani report to remove several SARS officials, reorganize SARS, cutting its enforcement capability and undermining its ability to ensure tax compliance by prominent political and underworld figures. This action on the basis of the Sekakani panel's report enabled in large part the recent capture of SARS as detailed by the Nugent Commission in his report. And then Mr. Pillay says Mr. Gordhan had annexed to his founding affidavit various references to two affidavits, which Mr. Pillay had provided to the public protector in the course of an investigation. And those are the two affidavits which I just taken the committee through. So that's before the court. And then Mr. Pillay says that he set out in considerable detail in those affidavits the facts and evidence at my disposal relevant first to the investigation, to the extent that the public protector had revealed such to him, and to the intended findings of the public protector. Go down. Contained in a section 7, I notice to him. And then it says, the public protector seems to parrot the conclusion by the Sekakani report that the establishment of the SARS investigative unit had contributed section 3 of the NSI Act, which it said prohibits the conducting of COVID intelligence gathering by structures other than that, the National Defense Force, the SAPS, or the SSA. Pillay merely confirmed the contents of his affidavit. Go down. These affidavits don't necessarily run parallel. Just for ease of convenience dealing with it, but they don't necessarily correspond in paragraph numbers. Mr. Gordhan says that he was advised that the conclusions were clearly wrong in law, that the establishment of the SARS investigative unit did not contravene Section 3, its activities was not subject to the provisions of Section 3 at all. Right. Mr. Pillay complains about the fact that the public protector sought to rely on selective extracts of the discredited and contested so-called panel report, which had been addressed in his affidavit dated 18 June 2019, and points out that paragraph 75.3 of the Sekakani panel report details the nature and extent of the limited intelligence work that was carried out. Paragraph 82 then states that as a general rule, you're going too quickly. It was accepted that the unit did not have the required equipment to carry out such electronic surveillance or interceptions. The public protector simply ignored these inconvenient parts of the report. Mr. Gordhan simply complains about the reliance on the Sekakani report, and then he quotes Gordhan. He refers to the Nugent Commission report, Gordhan. And he quotes the one paragraph that has been referred to the committee now on more than one occasion in respect of the Sikakani panel report, and I've read it to you out earlier. I'm not going to do it again. Go down. And the public protector ignores this finding of the Nugent Commission and instead clings tenaciously to the discredited conclusion reached by the Sikakani panel. Right? There is then a further affidavit dealing with part B, which the protector deals with. And in this regard, sorry, my apologies, I'm saying this incorrectly. The reference above is the date on which the Pillar Intervention Application Affidavit was filed, 1 August 2019. Now we come to part B. That is the part in which by then the public protector is now answering the substantive allegations dealing with the review application and the allegations which is related to the allegations found in Kodan's founding affidavit, right? To do that. And so in that regard, the public protector says, okay, so by the time the public protector answers these allegations, we have already had the judgment in respect of part A. And Patrol J has reached certain conclusions in that judgment. And so part of what the public protector answers in the answering affidavit also addresses what Patrol J had concluded in her judgment in that regard. So the PP says the High Court misdirected itself when it ruled that the public protector relies on the Sikakani panel's findings that the SARS investigative unit was unlawful because it contravened Section 3 of the NSI Act. Section 3.1 of the NSI Act prior to its amendment in 2013. Mr. Kudan submits that this section was not contravened because it applied only to those Department of States that were by law required to perform functions with regard to the security of the Republic or the combating of any threat to the security of the Republic. SARS was clearly not such a, you've gone too far. SARS was clearly not such a department. Furthermore, Section 3.1 did not prohibit all covert intelligence gathering, only covert departmental intelligence. Departmental intelligence is defined in the Act as intelligence about any threat or potential threat to the national security and stability of the Republic. She then explains that I found that the establishment of the SARS unit was in breach of Section 209 of the Constitution, in terms of which only the President may establish such covert information gathering unit. And then she quotes Section 209 of the Constitution and submits that SARS is not an intelligence service. And the definition of intelligence in the Act is, in fact, for purposes of informing any government decision, policy-making process carried out in order to protect or advance national security. SARS is thus not affected by Section 209 as its application is confined to the establishment dedicated to the protection of national security. That's effectively the argument that was made there, right? And then the allegations that is made by Mr. Kudan, and I'm going to take it from 85 to 96 and then come back up to see what the public protector says in respect of those allegations. So Mr. Kudan says the public protector relies heavily on the discredited report by the Sikakani panel in reaching erroneous findings. Then says that they rendered this report to Mr. Muyani, and we've dealt with that. Mr. Muyani also used the Sikakani report to remove several SARS officials. We've dealt with that. conclusions of the Sikakani report that the establishment of the SARS investigation unit had contravened Section 3, which it says prohibits the conduct of covert intelligence gathering by structures other than the National Defense Force, SAPS, and the Security Agency. And then I'm however advised by my legal representatives that this conclusion was wrong in law. Stop, Shevo. The establishment of the SARS investigative unit did not contravene it. Therefore, the public protector's reliance on the discredited and erroneous Sikakani's panel's report in reaching any finding or imposing any remedial action is wholly misplaced and erroneous. And let's see what the response was to those allegations. Mr. Godin's views are not necessarily shared by many lawyers. I was entitled to have regard to the many legal opinions expressed by different lawyers that she could access. It is denied, as will be shown at the hearing of this matter, that the Nugent Commission did not make any authoritative finding on the issue. At best, it was non-committal, even if it expressed some doubt. Further legal submissions will be made at the hearing of this matter. Mr. Godin has never sought to review and set aside the Sikakani panel report, so it is not clear on what legal basis he concludes that this report by an eminent senior counsel should be disregarded as discredited. The fact that some people, or even Mr. Godin, differ from Sikakani SC does not make the report discredited. Go down. Go to para 101. These allegations were similarly founded to be baseless in the final report of the Nugent Commission dated 11 December. And then it reads the other paragraph from the Nugent Commission report to which I referred you to. And the PP responds by saying the Nugent Commission simply offered no legal analysis of the legal issues that Sikakani panel dealt with. Of interest in its view, that it is relevant for its view on the legal position that Advocate Sikakani EC did not respond to its offer to support the position in its report. The Nugent Commission does not commit itself to a legal analysis that helps to appreciate the doubts it has on the conclusions of the Sikakani panel report. In any event, I'm not bound by the findings of the Nugent Commission or the recanted position of Judge Cruen. Go down. In 102, it simply says the public protector ignores the findings of the Nugent Commission and instead clings tenaciously to the discredited conclusion reached by the Sikakani panel. Minister Godin, after the Rule 53 record is filed, then files a supplementary founding affidavit. And then there's a response from the public protector to that. And he sets out the list of peoples and bodies that have investigated the same issues. And I think we would need to go, Shepo, to page 929 of the document. The PDF document. Wait, just hold on. I just want to get the... I think we're in the wrong volume. Just get you the right volume. Go to the number 5, volumes 13 to 24, and you go to page 929. So then, in the affidavit before court, there's the investigation by Mr. During the investigation, the public protector was made aware that Mr. Keletso Manyeki, a former SARS employee, had filed a complaint against SARS to the public protector in February 2012. His complaint related to, amongst others, the existence and recruitment of members and operations. Go down. And then it says that Mr. Pille had provided a comprehensive response. I had taken you to that early on. Go down. Paragraph 123 of his affidavit in response of the Section 79 notice issued to him, Mr. Pillay attested upon the receipt of his response, the former public protector informed SARS that she would consider the response and she would revert. There was no further communication. Go down. Then he deals with it. And then he says in paragraph 27.4, the establishment of the unit had been investigated by both the National Prosecuting Authority and the Directorate of Priority Crimes Investigation. And at that stage, despite the lengthy investigation and considerable expenditure, no one had to date been charged for the establishment of the unit. And then they say this must be viewed in conjunction with the candid findings of both the Crown Advisory Panel and the KPFG report. Go down. Both having renounced the initial statements that the unit was unlawful and had publicly apologized to those affected. Mm-hmm. And then they say it is evident that these facts were ignored by the public protector since they do not appear in the record and that the entire legal reasoning is based on the opinion of the Sekhukhani panel on the lawfulness of the establishment of the SARS investigative unit, which is widely considered to be incorrect. Then go back to the document that we were on. It stated that the allegations that the public protector relied entirely on the opinion of the Sekhukhani panel is not borne out by the facts. The report of the public protector had regard to a number of opinions, including those of Mr. Godan, who sought to persuade the public protector that there was nothing wrong with establishing a spying unit within SARS. The public protector found the Sekhukhani panel opinion persuasive and exercised their independent views on the true legal position. The narrative that the Sekhukhani panel report is widely considered to be incorrect is not binding on the public protector. It is in any event not correct that the Sekhukhani panel report is widely considered to be incorrect. Mr. Godan and those implicated in the report do not like the conclusion of the Sekhukhani panel report. The fact that they do not like the conclusions of the Sekhukhani panel report does not make it widely regarded as being incorrect. Godan. Further, the public protector was not bound by the Nugent findings. In fact, the Nugent Commission did not make conclusive findings that the establishment of the spying unit was permitted by law. The evidence of Judge Kroon was not binding on the public protector, and given his flip-flopping attitude on the issue, the public protector was correct to place no reliance on Judge Kroon. There is no evidence to support the allegation that the public protector did not consider legal opinions and unnamed forensic reports. The report lists the documents that the public protector considered purposes of lawfulness for purposes of the investigation. The Sekhukhani panel report made findings on the lawfulness of the spying unit within SARS that made sense. The public protector, however, exercised independent reasoning on the matter, which aligned with that of Sekhukhani. And then she basically again says that Nugent Commission was not binding. Mr. Godan does not identify the evidence in the Nugent Commission that was necessary for the PP to have regard to. The Nugent Commission's mandate is not the same as the public protector. And the Nugent Commission was established by the president, who determined its terms of reference. The terms of reference for the public protector is the Constitution, while that of the Nugent Commission is the president. And hence, the public protector should not be bound by the findings or evidence of the Nugent Commission. And then it sets out its view on what the interim report is about. Right. And then refers to what the Nugent Commission has said on the findings, which I've taken you to already. Go down. And so it deals with what a comparison between the status of a leading senior counsel and a retired judge. In any event, even the Nugent Commission was not prepared to give the spying unit a clean bill of health. Insofar as that related to its activities, the Nugent Commission leaves open the question whether the spying unit was involved in illegal activities. The public protector did not leave that question unanswered. The OIGI also made a definitive finding in the illegal activities that the spying unit was involved in. In the final Nugent Commission, it says the lawfulness of the spying unit was not definitively settled with reference to a legal analysis. On the lawfulness of the spying unit, the Nugent Commission said the following remarks. And it then deals with paragraph 9, which I had read earlier. This view does not definitively answer the question of whether SARS was entitled to establish the spying unit in question. The effort is made by the Nugent Commission to analyze any provisions of the law, including the Constitution and the National Strategic Intelligence Act, to reach a definitive finding on whether SARS is entitled to establish the spying unit. The Nugent Commission's opinion was not definitive on the question in this regard. So, and it then says that its comment was simply what it had stated, that there was nothing in the report to persuade it why the Sikakane report was not good. Go down. There's nothing in this paragraph that helps to understand the Nugent Commission's reasoning for disagreeing with Advocate Sikakane. He makes no reference to the content of the panel's findings and opinions and how it reasoned its way to the conclusion on the lawfulness of the spying unit. There's nothing but unsubstantiated views of the Nugent Commission that could assist an independent assessment of the true legal position relating to the establishment of the spying unit in its recommendations. Then deals with governance issues, and it says, more importantly, the Nugent Commission made no recommendations to re-establish the spying unit, which the OIGI had found to be established illegally. It makes no recommendation with reference to the law, how that unit should be re-established, and leaves it as a broad recommendation. The allegation that the public protector could have learned something useful for analysis of the law from the Nugent Commission report is belied by the contents of the report itself. It provides no analysis of the law that could have assisted the public protector at her work, constitutional work. Okay, but then repeats the allegations in respect of the Nugent Commission, and it goes further and says the public protector and the OIG did not, as statutory body involved in investigating the activities of intelligence organizations, the OIGI's report must be believed than the Nugent Commission. The public protector was entitled to believe and rely on the findings made by an appropriate body to the constitutional mandate to oversee the work of intelligence agencies as set out in the report of the IGI. Mr. Pillay then, in his founding affidavit, submitted that the Sikakane panel report was fatally flawed, and he then refers to a number of documents which says this out, and those allegations are not dealt with from that paragraph onwards in the report in the public protector's affidavit. So these allegations in Mr. Pillay's founding affidavit are not disputed in any answering papers. Go on. All right. And he deals with allegations about the Kroon apology paragraph in the Nugent inquiry. Go down. He says it again. And he makes the point on affidavit that the Crown Advisory Board then concluded that it was indeed wrong to have concluded this. I informed the public protector that these facts can be determined from retired Judge Crown and the members of the board directly. He then referred to the public records that existed that set out in detail the legality of the unit. He then deals with the Sikakani panel's paragraph that explains how they expanded their mandate and had not interviewed Mr. Van Lochenberg. We've dealt with that. Mr. Pillay confirms again that he didn't institute the Sikakani panel to investigate a rogue unit and that persons, multiple persons had not been given a hearing. Go down. Then he says, not only do I take issue with this factually flawed and contradictory nature of the content of the Sikakani panel report as set out in my critique, but also with what the report ignores and omits in this regard. And then he sets out what I've already read to you as having been contained in his previous affidavit, that which had been ignored, the allegations vis-a-vis Precker, what the attorney had said. Go down. And he says that his critique was not dealt with by the public protector. And then he points out that the report had been challenged by Mr. Van Lochenberg in the public domain, and that the public protector had no regard to it in the notice. Go down. He then makes certain allegations that it's irrational and ill-placed. And he repeats his allegations that Ms. Walters had pointed out to significant and fatal flaws in the Sikakani panel report under oath before the High Court in another matter, and that the allegation again changed with the introduction of vague and unexplained findings that the unit was unlawfully established. And that it had scant regard to the Sikakani panel. Go down. He then quotes what he had previously stated about the aborted negotiations with the NIA. And then he points out to what the Sikakani panel said in respect of that. Go down. We've already dealt with that. I read those paragraphs out to you earlier. Right. And the public protector then sought to rely on selective extracts of the discredited and contentious panel report, which I already addressed in his affidavit. And then he points out that during September 2014, Mr. Van Lochenberg placed the Sikakani panel in possession of direct allegations and evidence in support of threats to SARS, demonstrating various attack on SARS as an institution and undermining its officials. This was never mentioned in the report. Mr. Van Lochenberg was never afforded a hearing before the panel or a right to reply. And we know that before the public protector, Mr. Van Lochenberg also was not consulted. Chair, it's 1 o'clock. If we come back, it's a convenient place to stop, and then I will deal with what the court judgment says about the Sikakani report against the background of the evidence.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate Bauer. Yes, so we'll pause for lunch and take 45 minutes for lunch. We'll be back after 45 minutes, quarter to two. Thank you.
Recording stopped.